session number 11627, reel 2.
So Stephen Spender, reel 2.
Well, as I was saying, that strange coincidences, that the moment I'd finished my training, within 24 hours, the Blitz stopped. And then I was on a few fires. There were sort of 100 bomber raids a bit later. The moment I left, the V1 started. I mean, within 24 hours of my leaving the fire service. So my poor fellow fireman had a really terrible time, because I think the V1s were really, and the V2s were really worse than the Blitz. It was just was a continuous air raid.
It sounds then as though you finished your training in May 1941, because to my knowledge
that's right,
the Blitz suddenly finished.
Yes, that must have been
just before the attack on Russia, and then
I think it was a bit earlier than that. I don't think we switched from the Blitz within a matter of days or weeks even. I think there was a 6 month pause in which there were very few raids before the attack on Russia, I think.
And then the V1 raids started.
And then the
V1
started in June, yes. But anyhow, you can check on that.
But when you were doing the training, were you going out in the middle of the Blitz and
doing work? Yes.
Did you see anything of the famous raid on the city of London that occurred just after Christmas on May the 29th when St. Paul's was defended?
I may have been training then. At the very beginning of the war, for a term, I was a schoolmaster at Lundell School. That would be December 1939 about the following March or something like that. And then I came back and then I joined the fire service. I think it did take some time to join the fire service. I had to join the fire service. I just walked out into a fire station. But I don't think it was quite as simple as that. I'm sorry, I've really forgotten.
But you were in London during the Blitz, in any case.
Yes. Except the part that I was at Lundell's.
What did it feel like to see London being taken apart street by street in the Blitz?
I think one wasn't really often very often frightened. Then occasionally, if you were lying, I remember staying with a friend of mine who lived in Bourne Square, which of course was very near Victoria Station, and occasionally they seemed to be circling very, very low, but then I could work out our chance, the chances of actually being hit were really rather slight. I mean, if I imagined an enormous, very large area, like the whole of Salisbury Plain and something, and you imagine a bomb being dropped on you from the air, and you're in some particular point in Salisbury Plain, you do realise the chances of your being actually hit are rather remote. Although, as a matter of fact, later on when we were in Hampstead, that was when I was still in the fire service. Yes, I was still in the fire service. So that must have been one of the smaller raids. The house next door to us was actually hit, and the ceiling of our where we were living in a sort of a kind of garret, really, sort of upper story, sort of attic flat, and how all the ceilings fell in and so on. And then one did have a feeling, I mean, one heard this tremendous noise like a train coming out of a tunnel, which was the bomb. And I remember thinking, oh, this is something I've been waiting for all my life. This is the end.
But did you get the feeling that London couldn't possibly rise again from the ashes, that the destruction was so awful?
Well, I don't think so, no. I think you could always see that very, very large areas were involved. Occasionally I had to travel quite a lot to give readings or lectures or something to the north of England, say. And if you were in a train, say through the Black Country or something, you do realise that there was sort of the pre-atom bomb. I mean, you realised that very, very large areas were involved in the picture of industrial England. And so that even if a whole city like Coventry was ruined, there'd be vast areas still left.
What kind of work did you actually do in the fire service? Were you actually handling the hoses?
Yes. I did just what all the other firemen did, and climbed up hook ladders and things like that. On the few fires I was in, the other firemen always regarded me as rather incompetent and were extremely nice, I must say. I remember I was on top of a ladder, sort of hose, at the Russian embassy, I think, hosing a bit of a roof. The roof was on fire, and another fireman suddenly stood up at my side and said, "You can't do this, I'll do it. Let me do this, Stephen," and took the hose away from me.
How much danger was there involved in fighting the fires?
I have no idea. Well, I mean, I suppose there was... I really don't know. I mean, certainly those original fires, which I wasn't involved before I went into the fire service, the bombing of the docks and the city and so on, were very terrifying for the firemen.
What was the attitude to the people who were actually doing the bombing, to the German air crews? Did people hate them?
No. I had two anecdotes about that. Once I was in a train in my fireman's uniform, and there was a pilot. I was alone in the carriage with a pilot, and the pilot looked thoughtfully at me, a bomber pilot, I suppose, and he said, "You're the chaps we're sorry for." And so if you think what his mind was working, he was thinking that when they were bombing Germany, the firemen were the people they were sorry for. And then I remember a fireman at my fire station saying to me, "Well, you know Germany, don't you, Stephen? Don't you think that the people in Germany feel just the same about being bombed as we feel about being bombed here?" So I think the war was, in fact, one can't really say that in the services, in the civil defence services, that there was any hatred or very much hatred. I mean, I think people thought of it as being a job. To be a real anti-fascist, you had to be something of an intellectual. You had to know a bit about the history of fascism. And I think that most of my fellow firemen felt, well, this had happened, and they had to go through with it. And there was no question about that at all. They accepted that. They didn't feel it was an unjust war or something, like people might be feeling about it. There was a war about Iraq now. they accepted the idea that it was a just war, but they didn't feel it was necessary to hate the Germans, or even to understand about the Nazis. This is very much in contrast with the First World War, because I do remember, I was about eight or nine during the First World War, and there were those absolutely terrible hatreds, which was almost the ugliest aspect of the war, and people in Germans, people even who had German relations, like I did in my own family, were really subject to persecution.
I asked you earlier about the lectures which you gave in the fire service on the future of Britain after the war, but we didn't really get round to your saying.
Oh, yes. Well, as a result of the fact that there was really nothing for the civil defence services to do, there was a question of what they should do. And this gave an opportunity to various firemen, I've forgotten quite who, to start an education scheme in the fire service, which was supported by Herbert Morrison and people like that in the London County Council, or perhaps he was Home Secretary or something. And we were given facilities to do this. And so we weren't promoted. We were sort of education officers without promotion. And I was one of the organizers, really. And the speakers we got, and I'm sure this is also true of ABCA, I mean, the things going on in the army, all the speakers we got were left-wing and had very idealistic concepts of rebuilding London. I mean, they regarded the bombing, I mean, this was quite a good attitude that the firemen shared. Now London's been destroyed, the slums have been destroyed, let's build a beautiful city. So we had a lot of bad planning. For instance, there was going to be a continuous green park stretching from ruined St. Paul's down to the embankment and extending as far as St. James's Park, I suppose it would, you see, so that St. Paul's Cathedral would be magnificently isolated. And there were all sorts of planners who had plans of this and could show us pictures of it and so on. And this was very successful. It went very well, this education scheme.
Why should they all have been left wing?
I don't know. Perhaps we only asked left wing people. Perhaps we only knew left wing people. I don't think there were very few conservatives. There was a funny moment when I asked Count Karelé, who had been Prime Minister of Hungary and who was a friend of ours, and to speak. And this very impressed, that we got Count Karelé, former Prime Minister of Hungary, impressed the fire service very much. And I think various sort of fire chiefs turned up to his lecture. And he said, "I don't tell you firemen, I tell you, firemen, not to put out the fires, but to set the fires of Europe alight," and so on. This was very badly received. My position was rather precarious for a few days after.
What exactly did he mean by that?
Well, he meant there should be a revolution. He was still, I mean, he had been a revolutionary prime minister, I think. He was a great aristocrat, as a matter of fact, but he was also, I think he was Prime Minister before Bela Kun,
the communist. 1919.
And then he was asked back, in 1945, he was asked back to Hungary and became Foreign Minister. But he didn't get on with the communists, as a matter of fact.
What did you feel about the role of the royal family in the war?
Well, I thought it was their best moment. I remember one or two times I met the Queen. I remember the Queen said to me, "Well, it was really the happiest time of our lives." Of course, I think that they felt the royal family did behave very well, the King and Queen did behave very well. They were very brave. Whenever a city was bombed, they immediately went to visit the people. They were obviously clearly loved by the people whom they visited. No political leader, except possibly Churchill, but not even always Churchill, could go to a bombed city and it not be held responsible for the war. I think for the people sort of identified with the royal family that they were sort of representative of the victims and of being bombed and of resisting, and I think they came out very well. Don't you?
Yes, I do. So, you mean that sometimes when politicians went to bomb cities, they would meet with hostility?
Yes. And Hitler, I think, never went to a bomb city. And I don't know whether, I don't know, Goebbels must have, but I don't think Goering did.
What do you remember about the entry of the Soviet Union and the USA into the war in 1941 and the impact of those events on you personally?
Oh, well, I was tremendously glad. I mean, I thought that it really meant that we would win the war. It was then, for the first few weeks, though, until October 1941, it was extremely discouraging, and it looked very much as if the Russians would take, as if the Germans would take Moscow and Leningrad and St. Petersburg. Leningrad, I mean. And then that would have been terrible, of course, But I think that there was a feeling that really this was the turning point of the war, I think, at the time, too.
After that event, there was quite a lot of adulation for Stalin and the Red Army in Britain. What was your feeling about all that?
Well, I never felt any adulation for Stalin, I must say. But, of course, I did for the Red Army, yes, and for the Russian people, I suppose, yes.
But did you feel that people were going over the top about it, being excessive about it?
Yes, I did, quite often, yes.
You said in your writings that you applied for this job at the Foreign Office and that you got the job in an intelligence branch of the Foreign Office. Is it possible to say what that was?
Yes. Well, it was a very minor job. It was eventually, you see, with the aim of that I should be, as a person who knew Germany, and knew a bit of German, and knew German intellectuals and so on, that I should be part of the occupying forces in Germany. But I was first sent to a branch of the Foreign Office, which is really, we were sort of studying things. We were studying the nature of fascism, Italian fascism, as a matter of fact, and the Italian, the structure of Italian fascism, the Ente, and so on. And I think we were putting together, that's right, we were putting together some kind of information which could be used for the occupying forces in Italy. Then as soon as the war was over, I was switched to Germany, and then I was supposed in Germany I was opening libraries which had been closed by the occupying forces at the end of the war was, and had to be denazified. I describe it all in a book called European Witness.
Who was the tutor at the Foreign Office who was instructing you all? Does he stand out in your mind at all?
No. I don't think I had a tutor. There was a man called Klebanski who was head of the branch, the Italian branch that I was talking about. Then I think I just went. I just went out with sort of papers which told what I was supposed to do, and when I got to Germany, then I was given a car and a driver, and I just made my own arrangements to open these libraries.
What was the name of the branch of the Foreign Office to which you were attached?
I don't know. I was a civilian military officer, something we had some kind of very as a major, given the rank equivalent to a major. But we had some kind of tab which said you were a civilian military officer, which is a contradiction in terms, but which explained what we were.
The tab said CMO, did it?
I think so, something like that, yes.
What did you think of the state of Germany when you got there?
Well, I was appalled, really. Someone, incidentally, you should probably interview is Paul Binding, who just wrote a very remarkable book about being a child as a member of the occupying forces, which has just been a novel, which has just been published.
So you were appalled at the destruction of the cities?
Oh, yes, I thought it was... There I did find a lot of the officials were very, unlike my fellow firemen, unlike the ordinary soldiers, I think, were very vindictive.
How can you explain the difference?
I think part they'd got into... partly because that the occupying of Germany got into the hands of very vindictive people. I don't know why. I remember when I was interviewed, in fact, when I was first interviewed for this job by a War Office committee, I was entirely rejected because they asked me what I thought about occupying Germany, and I said, well, I thought... But one very important thing is that we should get the English universities in touch with the German universities, and that we should do everything we could to encourage the German universities and the German intellectuals and so on. In fact, my whole line is that we should avoid the kind of mistakes which were made after the First World War. And this is it, and I was turned down at once. And they said very brutal things, really. The Germans should be...
What was the attitude of the German population towards the occupying forces from your own personal perception of it?
Well, the German population, it was curious, really. It was as though they didn't see us at all. It was as though, I mean, they were entirely in their kind of driven down neurotic world, I think. And, I mean, they were sort of crawling about there in towns. They were really crawling about their ruins. And even driving through towns, you had to be very careful because you had the impression... That they didn't see your car, they didn't see the occupiers at all. There was a kind of screen between us and them, which made us sort of almost invisible to them. This was very early on. This was May, you see, at the time of what was it called? You weren't allowed to talk to Germans.
Non-fraternization,
yes. I was given a sort of special leave to talk to them.
So they were. It seems as though they were trying to shut the idea of the defeat out of their minds.
I think they accepted the defeat. I think they probably accepted the defeat, but I think that I think they really were entirely in their own world. I mean, they really had been. It was as though they were sort of living in cellars. And a lot of them were living in cellars.
How did they take to the job that you had to carry out with the libraries and so on?
Well, of course, these were people who still were in their jobs. They were always quite friendly and quite nice. I remember one of them saying, I understand exactly what I have to do. I have to take down the Nazi books which are on the shelves and bring up the Jewish books from the cellars and put them on the shelves.
What did you say to that?
I said, yeah, that's exactly it.
Did he or she say it with a twinkle in their eye or what?
No, not at all, no. And then I had to try to find out whether from the assistants, whether the people in control of them, the librarians, were Nazis or not.
How did you go about that?
I just asked them. And I was rather lenient, I think. I mean, librarians are not really very party sort of people. So, I didn't go into it very deeply. I just sort of formed my own impression of the...
Did your period with the occupation forces after the war change your attitude towards the Germans?
No. I had a great friend, Hans Robert Curtius, whom I'd known. That's partly why I wanted to go to Bonn, because he was living in Bonn, a professor at Bonn. A very distinguished man, a very international figure, really. And he was the greatest authority in Germany on French literature, for instance. He was sort of typical of people like him. I mean, they were embittered about everything. They were embittered about the Nazis. They looked on the Nazis as something that had happened to them. And they were... And of course, there were this frightful bombing. This was near the Roland. I mean, really appalling things that happened in Essen. And total ruin.
So they didn't feel that anybody had behaved well.
They were pleased the war was over, and they.